Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications 2012. English for Speakers of Other Languages, Higher. Section A, Listening. Recording 1. Listen to the talk. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 1, before you hear the recording.
Few of us appreciate backseat drivers, but more and more of us are now relying on voices in our cars to tell us what to do. Sat-navs have replaced maps, and new cars are crammed with technology, all too willing to give us advice or instructions. Something that has been exercising the car industry is what kind of voice would make you listen. Stuart Edwards has been finding out.
I've been to the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab at Stanford University, which does much of the work for the world's big car companies. So the question is, how should your car talk to you so it doesn't make you angry, and so, the research shows, a worse driver? When I was at the lab, a human guinea pig was in a car seat. Ahead of her was a screen with a road and a lot of traffic coming towards her. The driving conditions can be changed so it feels to the driver in the simulator that it's windy or the road is slippery. The driver was wired with sensors to detect heartbeat and perspiration and all the signs of calmness or tension. So, what can we learn from this? The first thing we discover is that the drivers who are feeling down react best to a depressed, boring car voice. They drive much worse with a cheerful voice. Professor Ross, whose laboratory this is, concludes that the proverb, misery loves company, is wrong. It should be, misery loves miserable company. In his spare time, Professor Ross is a magician. The magic he's working for the car companies is to devise a voice that makes driving safer, but also a voice to give the car a character that you like, so it seems like your friend. Professor Ross told me that a Japanese car company developed voices that warned drivers when they were driving badly. In laboratory tests, the first voice said, for example, "You are not driving well. Please try to drive carefully," which annoyed drivers and their driving worsened. So it's important that the car gets its soothing words right. His star turn, though, is his work on voice mimicry. He's done experiments that show that we like it when people copy us, but hate it if the copy is so close that it's mimicry. So he's developed a way for the car's voice to change as you, the driver, talk to it. And that, he says, is what humans do unconsciously. Imagine if the voice of your car morphed by mimicking you and got to seem familiar, like your trusted friend, your buddy. The companies, though, initially got worried by this development. They feared that people would be loath to sell their cars. It would be like relinquishing an old, frayed, but faithful friend. But what if the character of your old car could just be transferred to your new one, simply by moving a cheap computer chip? That, the companies thought, would be simply brilliant. They could then say, if you buy my brand, your old buddy will be with you. Buy from another company and you're starting from scratch. So with this development, the car companies went, ching!
Few of us appreciate backseat drivers, but more and more of us are now relying on voices in our cars to tell us what to do. Sat-navs have replaced maps, and new cars are crammed with technology, all too willing to give us advice or instructions. Something that has been exercising the car industry is what kind of voice would make you listen. Stuart Edwards has been finding out.
I've been to the Communication Between Humans and Interactive Media Lab at Stanford University, which does much of the work for the world's big car companies. So the question is, how should your car talk to you so it doesn't make you angry, and so, the research shows, a worse driver? When I was at the lab, a human guinea pig was in a car seat. Ahead of her was a screen with a road and a lot of traffic coming towards her. The driving conditions can be changed so it feels to the driver in the simulator that it's windy or the road is slippery. The driver was wired with sensors to detect heartbeat and perspiration and all the signs of calmness or tension. So, what can we learn from this? The first thing we discover is that the drivers who are feeling down react best to a depressed, boring car voice. They drive much worse with a cheerful voice. Professor Ross, whose laboratory this is, concludes that the proverb, "Misery loves company," is wrong. It should be, "Misery loves miserable company." In his spare time, Professor Ross is a magician. The magic he's working for the car companies is to devise a voice that makes driving safer, but also a voice to give the car a character that you like, so it seems like your friend. Professor Ross told me that a Japanese car company developed voices that warned drivers when they were driving badly. In laboratory tests, the first voice said, for example, "You are not driving well. Please try to drive carefully," which annoyed drivers and their driving worsened. So it's important that the car gets its soothing words right. His star turn, though, is his work on voice mimicry. He's done experiments that show that we like it when people copy us, but hate it if the copy is so close that it's mimicry. So he's developed a way for the car's voice to change as you, the driver, talk to it. And that, he says, is what humans do unconsciously. Imagine if the voice of your car morphed by mimicking you and got to seem familiar, like your trusted friend, your buddy. The companies, though, initially got worried by this development. They feared that people would be loath to sell their cars. It would be like relinquishing an old, frayed, but faithful friend. But what if the character of your old car could just be transferred to your new one, simply by moving a cheap computer chip? That, the companies thought, would be simply brilliant. They could then say, "If you buy my brand, your old buddy will be with you. Buy from another company and you're starting from scratch." So with this development, the car companies went, ching!
Recording 2. Listen to the radio interview. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 2, before you hear the recording.
Good morning and welcome to Start the Week. Our first topic today is why office work is bad for us and fixing things feels good. This is the long title of a short book by Michael Lister, who is a philosopher who runs a motorbike repair shop and thinks Western culture is accelerating dangerously down the wrong road. Michael, let's start with a bit of history. You begin the book with the arrival of what industrialisation did to work and the way time management experts broke up work into tiny segments.
Essentially, it was an effort to separate thinking from doing by gathering all the craft knowledge that was scattered in the heads of craftsmen and installing it in a process, the assembly line, which, once it's designed, requires no ongoing deliberate effort on the part of those who man it. The point being, of course, to replace skilled workers with unskilled workers.
Yes, cheaper, rule-based. I hadn't realised that when Henry Ford famously tried this out, a huge proportion of people loathed it so much they walked away very early on.
Well, that's right. When he wanted to add 100 workers to the line, it was necessary to hire 963, such was the attrition rate. And it was because these were people recruited initially from bicycle shops, carriage shops. They were all-round mechanics who knew what they were doing, and to be reduced to pulling the lever on a machine was repugnant to them. And this is a logic that you see throughout the modern economy in an effort to dumb jobs down, again, for the sake of labour costs. And you see it now in the office, where there's the electronic sweatshop phenomenon, which can be every bit as stultifying as the assembly line.
And we're taught in this country by our politicians that a sign of our advance is having an ever greater percentage of people going to university and then doing white-collar jobs of one kind or another. You would argue this is not only dehumanising for a lot of people, but it's actually economically barmy.
Yeah. The book began with a reflection on my own work experience. I worked as an electrician and as a mechanic, and I often felt more challenged intellectually doing that work than in other white-collar jobs that were officially designated as knowledge work. A further irony is that I also earn more money as an unlicensed electrician than as a college graduate.
And your argument is partly that all the jobs that can be done electronically are being outsourced anyway, so you're going to lose your job eventually.
Well, that seems to have happened to a lot of accountants, programmers, even editors. But by contrast, you can't fix a leaking toilet over the internet. So there's a certain job security that comes from that.
But the core of your argument is that, intellectually and almost morally, it's superior to do something that involves handwork. Explain to us why.
I think I would state it not quite as strongly as that, but I think there is an ethical dimension. Any time you're dealing with a concrete reality that lets you know right away when you've got something wrong. For example, when repairing a motorbike, it either starts and it runs right or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, there's no getting away from it. When using your hands, you end up relying on the kind of judgment that comes from experience. We put a great emphasis on a certain type of knowledge in our society, namely knowledge that something is the case as opposed to knowing how. Know-how, as we say. It's a different kind of knowledge that can only come from experience.
And in terms of living a good life, there is something about the direct, hands-on business of fixing things and being in charge of your own stuff.
I think the experience of seeing a direct effect of your own actions has become somewhat elusive in modern life, partly because of efforts in the workplace to remove elements of judgment.
Good morning and welcome to Start the Week. Our first topic today is why office work is bad for us and fixing things feels good. This is the long title of a short book by Michael Lister, who is a philosopher who runs a motorbike repair shop and thinks Western culture is accelerating dangerously down the wrong road. Michael, let's start with a bit of history. You begin the book with the arrival of what industrialisation did to work and the way time management experts broke up work into tiny segments.
Essentially, it was an effort to separate thinking from doing. By gathering all the craft knowledge that was scattered in the heads of craftsmen and installing it in a process, the assembly line, which, once it's designed, requires no ongoing deliberate effort on the part of those who man it. The point being, of course, to replace skilled workers with unskilled workers.
Yes, cheaper, rule-based. I hadn't realised that when Henry Ford famously tried this out, a huge proportion of people loathed it so much they walked away very early on.
Well, that's right. When he wanted to add 100 workers to the line, it was necessary to hire 963, such was the attrition rate. And it was because these were people recruited initially from bicycle shops, carriage shops. They were all-round mechanics who knew what they were doing, and to be reduced to pulling the lever on a machine was repugnant to them. And this is a logic that you see throughout the modern economy in an effort to dumb jobs down, again for the sake of labour costs. And you see it now in the office, where there's the electronic sweatshop phenomenon, which can be every bit as stultifying as the assembly line.
And we're taught in this country by our politicians that a sign of our advance is having an ever greater percentage of people going to university and then doing white-collar jobs of one kind or another. You would argue this is not only dehumanising for a lot of people, but it's actually economically barmy.
Yeah. The book began with a reflection on my own work experience. I worked as an electrician and as a mechanic, and I often felt more challenged intellectually doing that work than in other white-collar jobs that were officially designated as knowledge work. A further irony is that I also earn more money as an unlicensed electrician than as a college graduate.
And your argument is partly that all the jobs that can be done electronically are being outsourced anyway, so you're going to lose your job eventually.
Well, that seems to have happened to a lot of accountants, programmers, even editors. But by contrast, you can't fix a leaking toilet over the internet. So there's a certain job security that comes from that.
But the core of your argument is that, intellectually and almost morally, it's superior to do something that involves handwork. Explain to us why.
I think I would state it not quite as strongly as that, but I think there is an ethical dimension. Any time you're dealing with a concrete reality that lets you know right away when you've got something wrong. For example, when repairing a motorbike, it either starts and it runs right or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, there's no getting away from it. When using your hands, you end up relying on the kind of judgment that comes from experience. We put a great emphasis on a certain type of knowledge in our society, namely knowledge that something is the case as opposed to knowing how. Know-how, as we say. It's a different kind of knowledge that can only come from experience.
And in terms of living a good life, there is something about the direct, hands-on business of fixing things and being in charge of your own stuff.
I think the experience of seeing a direct effect of your own actions has become somewhat elusive in modern life, partly because of efforts in the workplace to remove elements of judgment.
Recording 3. Listen to the short story extract. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 3, before you hear the recording.
Thanks for listening. That's all from me today, but as usual, before the 11 o'clock news, we have the short story of the day, which today is set in 1940s Paris.
That year, 1946, winter was a long time going. Although it was April, a freezing wind blew through the streets of the city, and overhead the snow clouds moved across the sky. The old man, who was called Rioli, shuffled painfully along the pavement. He was cold and miserable, huddled up like a hedgehog in a filthy black coat, only his eyes and the top of his head visible above the turned-up collar. He continued to walk until he reached a picture gallery, where there was a single canvas on display in the window. He stopped briefly to look at it. Then, just as he turned to go on, he noticed that attached to the frame there was a little plaque, and on this the name Pierre Duval, 1897-1943. Rioli stared at the picture, wondering vaguely what there was about it that seemed familiar. "Pierre!" he cried suddenly. "That's who it is!" Rioli pressed his face closer to the window. He could remember the boy. But when? Yes, it was the year before the war, the First War, 1913. He remembered Pierre, that sullen, brooding boy whom he had liked for no reason at all that he could think of, except that he could paint. He allowed his mind to run back over the years. How could he have forgotten him? My little apprentice with a picture in the finest shop in Paris! Such a long time had passed, but it was all coming back more clearly now. Where was it the boy had lived? Of course, it was in the northwest of the city. Ah, yes, he remembered it now. But which street? Yes, he remembered that now as well. It was all the boy could afford at the time. Rioli could almost see the street, the line of dustbins along the length of it, the rotten smell, the brown cats walking delicately over the refuse, and then the women. Moist, fat women sitting on the doorsteps with their feet upon the cobblestones of the street. Rioli then began to picture the studio with the chair in it and the filthy red couch that the boy had used for sleeping, the drunken parties and the cheap white wine, and always, always the bitter, sullen face of the boy brooding over his work. Yes, and there was all that nonsense with the tattoos, for instance on that one day that Rioli had got rich. He could see himself now as he entered the studio where his wife was standing in the centre of the room posing for her picture. "Tonight we shall celebrate," Rioli had said. "What are we celebrating?" the boy asked. "Is it that you've decided to divorce your wife so she can marry me?" "No," Rioli said. "We celebrate because today I have made a great sum of money with my work." It was true he had never tattooed as many as 9 arms before in one day. 9 boozy soldiers, and the remarkable thing was that no fewer than 7 of them had been able to pay in cash. This had made him suddenly and extremely rich. But the work was terrible on his eyes, and he...
Thanks for listening. That's all from me today, but as usual, before the 11 o'clock news, we have the short story of the day, which today is set in 1940s Paris.
That year, 1946, winter was a long time going. Although it was April, a freezing wind blew through the streets of the city, and overhead the snow clouds moved across the sky. The old man, who was called Rioli, shuffled painfully along the pavement. He was cold and miserable, huddled up like a hedgehog in a filthy black coat, only his eyes and the top of his head visible above the turned-up collar. He continued to walk until he reached a picture gallery, where there was a single canvas on display in the window. He stopped briefly to look at it. Then, just as he turned to go on, he noticed that attached to the frame there was a little plaque, and on this the name Pierre Duval, 1897-1943. Rioli stared at the picture, wondering vaguely what there was about it that seemed familiar. "Pierre!" he cried suddenly. "That's who it is!" Rioli pressed his face closer to the window. He could remember the boy. But when? Yes, it was the year before the war, the First War, 1913. He remembered Pierre, that sullen, brooding boy whom he had liked for no reason at all that he could think of, except that he could paint. He allowed his mind to run back over the years. How could he have forgotten him? My little apprentice with a picture in the finest shop in Paris! Such a long time had passed, but it was all coming back more clearly now. Where was it the boy had lived? Of course it was in the northwest of the city. Ah, yes, he remembered it now. But which street? Yes, he remembered that now as well. It was all the boy could afford at the time. Drioli could almost see the street, the line of dustbins along the length of it, the rotten smell, the brown cats walking delicately over the refuse, and then the women, moist, fat women sitting on the doorsteps with their feet upon the cobblestones of the street. Drioli then began to picture the studio with the chair in it and the filthy red couch that the boy had used for sleeping, the drunken parties and the cheap white wine, and always, always the bitter, sullen face of the boy brooding over his work. Yes, and there was all that nonsense with the tattoos. For instance, on that one day that Drioli had got rich, he could see himself now as he entered the studio where his wife was standing in the centre of the room posing for her picture. "Tonight we shall celebrate," Drioli had said. "What are we celebrating?" the boy asked. "Is it that you've decided to divorce your wife so she can marry me?" "No," Drioli said. "We celebrate because today I have made a great sum of money with my work." It was true he had never tattooed as many as 9 arms before in one day. 9 boozy soldiers, and the remarkable thing was that no fewer than 7 of them had been able to pay in cash. This had made him suddenly and extremely rich. But the work was terrible on his eyes, and he...
You now have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.